Welcome to Idle Chatter, brought to you by the Machinery Digest, where steel and soil meet. A weekly podcast by a New Jersey farmer to all farmers and ranchers across this great nation. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey. Regardless of the crop you grow or the livestock you raise, we all have one thing in common. Agriculture runs on passion, sweat, tears, and machinery. And that is why the Machinery Digest exists. A no-nonsense, grease-under-your-fingernails educational website. It was created to provide a transfer of knowledge so that you can maintain, service, and most importantly, understand today's complex farm equipment. My name is Ray Bohax, and I farm too. It is time now to get under the sheet metal. Hello and welcome to Idle Chatter. I'm Ray Bohax, coming to you from Cat Swamp Road in Warren County, New Jersey, and my show is part of the Farm Machinery Digest. So welcome to all that have been listening in the past, and welcome to anybody that's new that happens to be listening for the first time. And to those that are new, I ask you to please go to my website, farmmachinerydigest.com, and there you could find a lot of technical articles about equipment. You could find some interesting videos. My editorial column, today they don't call them editorials, right? I grew up, I'm old school, they called them an editorial in a magazine, an op-ed or an opinion editorial. Today they call them blogs. So if you want to call it a blog, that's fine. It is called Flags Across the Harvest. So you could check that out. And also my toolbox test, which is a monthly test, and it's meant to be very educational and fun. It's only 5 questions, multiple choice answers, so you don't have to do much work. And hopefully it's not, you know, it's like any test in life. It's not what you get on it, and the person that's giving you the test in most instances is not really concerned. Yes, in school you may need to get a certain grade to pass something. But often our tests in life are to prove to us what we know or don't know, and then also to learn from it. And the way the toolbox test is set up, it's meant for you to learn. So I give you an explanation of why that answer is correct. So check it out. It's very simple. All you do is hit submit, and like I tell people, that don't worry, I will not know who you are, especially if you have some crazy email address. All I do is get an email back to me saying that this person with this email address took the test. I don't know who they are, I don't know anything about you, and I know from our analytics that a lot of people go and read the test, but they're afraid to submit the answers because they think that I'm going to know. So do not be concerned with that whatsoever. The purpose of my website and my show, Idle Chatter, is education, because the educated farmer is the most profitable one. So anytime that you get some education, then that is what is going to help you to grow and help you to grow your business. So take that toolbox test, submit it, get your answers back, and go from there. And no worries, no concerns. I'm not going to know who you are. So hopefully everything is going well on your place. Your operation today is the first week in August, and the sun is shining here today in Warren County. It's actually quite a beautiful day. There's not a cloud in the sky as I'm looking up out of my window. My office is in the basement of our farmhouse, right? I mean, I'm not supposed to tell you that, but I guess I probably said that to you before. I mean, I don't hide anything whatsoever. With me, what you see is what you get, and my office is in the basement, so I have to kind of squint to look up through the window. But it is what I would call here a Colby, Kansas day. And why I call it a Colby, Kansas day is many years ago I was coming back from the Bonneville Salt Flats of Speed Week. And years prior to that, many years prior to that, my friend Glenn Nadell and I went across country. He had a cassette tape, An Evening with John Denver. And there was a song on that tape called Matthew. And John Denver sung about, I guess it was his great uncle or uncle, and came from Colby, Kansas. So for many years, I was desirous to go to Colby, Kansas, knowing nothing about it. And then when I came from Colorado into Kansas on back roads, I saw a sign that said Colby. And it was a gorgeous, gorgeous, beautiful day, probably about 82, 83 degrees, no humidity, and that gorgeous Kansas blue sky. So I stopped on the outskirts of Colby, Kansas, and spent the whole day walking around. There was an old farm equipment dealer there, and walked down some dirt roads. It was fantastic. So I always told my wife, when it's a day like this, it's a Colby, Kansas day, and I'm getting that wanderlust in me. So I'm of Ukrainian heritage. That's what my name is, Bohax. In Ukraine, it's Bohach, but we've been here for 100 years. I'm American, red, white, and blue. But I guess the Ukrainians maybe were gypsies or something, because I do have that wanderlust in me, and love to travel the back roads of my beloved America, go see a dirt road, go down a dirt road and see what you find. So I'm getting that wanderlust in me today with this Colby, Kansas, beautiful Kansas sky, Kansas-type sky, so to say. It's never quite as blue in New Jersey, the sky, as it is in Kansas. So hopefully, as I said, you're having a good day in your operation, and that your crops are going along well, growing well, and things are looking up. That's basically it, right? We can only wish for the best and keep moving forward. That's what farming is all about. The scriptures tell us, right, that the farmer puts his hand to the plow, even though we don't plow anymore, puts the hand to the plow and does not look over his shoulder backwards. So we move forward in agriculture. And that's the American spirit of the American farmer. And that spirit, the spirit of the American farmer, has also gone around the world. And there's farmers that have that same spirit in different parts of the world and different parts of different continents. But it is the spirit of the American farmer and American ingenuity. So what we are going to talk about today is the Lowly EGR system. And I felt that it was important for me to do a show on this. I've touched on this briefly over the past year. I think, believe it or not, this is podcast number 53. So that means that we have actually 54 podcasts in our inventory, in our archives on the website, and farmmachinerydigest.com website. And the first podcast was a short introductory podcast, and I was originally going to just number them, zero, and I started with 00, so that's why this is number 53, but really number 54, if that makes sense, because I started with 00. But then when I got involved with having my show, one of the first hosting sites is Ag Daily from Carbon Media, and they hosted my show, and they still do host my show every week. Great site, Ag Daily. We also have a lot of videos up there, and that's part of the Carbon Media Group, and it's like an internet-based television station. If you haven't checked it out before, Carbon Media, it's quite good. And Ryan Tips from Ag Daily suggested that I do not number them like that, that I give them a title. So I wanted to give them a title, because coming from the magazine world, you always have to give somebody a catchy title. So he suggested that I don't number them and I give them a title. But this is actually podcast number 53. So it's a year's worth of podcasts, even though the site and the show didn't launch until October. As I've told you before, I wanted to have some shows in inventory. So I did about 8 or 10 shows once a week. And then after we got our cover crop in, I started the official or semi-official launch. So in the past, when I spoke about OBD2, that's gasoline motors, when I spoke about Tier 4 emissions, in the archives, I do have a Tier 4 emission show, so you may want to check that out if you're interested. And I touched on EGR, but I felt that EGR has enough meat to it that I wanted to do an entire show on it. So that's what today is about. And we also have a letter for our special delivery section. Then again, for those that are new and those that are old, please forgive my repetition, that the special delivery is where people send me a letter at hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com, and then I take that letter if I happen to choose it. The reason why I'm saying that, because you get 3 or 4 letters in a week, or you get sometimes more, sometimes less, and I can't obviously spend the whole show answering letters. I did do one show with that back early on, but I tried not to to do that, try to cover a dedicated subject. So I do have a letter here, and it is from a gentleman who's been a fan right from the beginning of the show and has written me a number of times and with different questions. And what's really great about his questions are that they are very broad-based, so they're applicable to to almost everyone that's listening. And even though his question today is based upon a turbocharger on a car engine, the same would apply for a turbocharger and a piece of farm equipment. So we will get to that at the end of the show. But without any further ado, let's talk about EGR. Now, I'm going to give you, first of all, what does EGR stand for? It stands for exhaust gas recirculation. So that is what the letters indicate. Now, there's a little history behind EGR, and EGR actually started on gasoline motors. And the first use of EGR on a gasoline motor was in 1972 on Buick engines. Buick was the first ones to bring EGR out into the auto industry as an emission control device. And then by 1973, almost every manufacturer used some type of EGR system, EGR valve, and then it progressed from there. And then probably in the late 70s, early 80s, when General Motors came out with the Oldsmobile-based 355.7-liter diesel that they had in the cars. It was based on an Oldsmobile block. And then more truck-based 6.2-liter that they used an EGR valve. And then as time went on and emission control standards tightened in both the on-road trucking industry and then in the off-road industry, which would be farming equipment, obviously quantified as off-road and qualified, I should say, as off-road, and then construction equipment, mining equipment, what have you, and possibly even other diesel applications, is that EGR progressed that. So the tenet of EGR is the same regardless if it's a 1972 Buick or a 2020 combine, John Deere combine, or Mack truck, what have you. So the purpose of EGR is the same, but I want to give you its transition so that you can understand. Well, what had basically happened, there was the Clean Air Act of 1970, and then even prior to the Clean Air Act of 1970, and that turned back, and that just affected gasoline engines and predominantly production cars. It really wasn't anything much more than that. And it was recognized prior to that, because all of these acts, once they become an act of Congress, they take years to implement prior to that before it gets passed on. And then also there is usually a period for the auto manufacturers or the construction industry or the agriculture industry to meet that standard. They can't pull out a new law and then a new standard and have the people expect to meet it overnight, because there's usually a lot of engineering and testing that's involved. So there is this inherent lag time from when the act is introduced until it's actually implemented. I mean, it's like soil structure, right? You could determine that you need to build your organic matter. The day that you determine to realize that and recognize it and make and want to go on a quest to build organic matter, there's no difference in organic matter that day, and it may take 5 or 10 years for you to actually see a change in organic matter. And we've been fighting that in our farm. I've been fighting it for probably about, my dad has passed away in 2010, so 9 years. Since he passed away, 8 or 9 years fighting to build organic matter. And as an aside to that, it's so sad, because so many things in life are so quickly destroyed, so easily destroyed. I mean, right, you could cut down a tree in a forest that took 100 years to grow, and you could cut it down in 3 minutes with a chainsaw. And, same thing with organic matter. I read some information, or I heard it, or I read it. I don't remember whether I read it or dreamt it, but anyway, I think somebody read it on a radio show. That's where I think it was. They read it from some university testing. That's what it was, and that's why I got confused. And this testing, I don't remember what university it was, but they claimed that each tillage pass pass will reduce your organic matter content by 0.5%. So that's pretty drastic, because it takes a long time, a long time to build 0.5% of OM, and you could go in there with the plow and burn that up, release that carbon into the air from one tillage pass 0.5%. So, you know, what does that have to do with EGR? Well, probably nothing. No, it does. Not because organic matter going into the air is nitrogen going to the air, but what EGR, what was realized, for me to get back on track for you, sorry, is that the government drove the industry, recognized that we have a pollution problem, air pollution problem in the country, and that we need to do something about it, and the automobile was the predominant polluter. Industry was a polluter also, but the automobile was a predominant polluter because of it, of so many of them on the road, and also because they are mobile. So you could bring, it has the potential to bring air pollution anywhere, whereas a factory or a power plant or what have you would only pollute the air in that particular region, and then obviously the wind currents could move it, but you could go with a car and drive up to the top of a mountain or down into the desert or whatever, into a city, and you'd be spewing some sort of pollutants. And it was recognized of what pollutants need to be controlled first. And there was carbon monoxide, CO, which is partially burned fuel. There's hydrocarbons, HC, which is unburned fuel. And then what they determined was another pollutant, which is called oxides of nitrogen. So that's capital N, if you chemistry people, capital N, capital O, subscript X, oxides of nitrogen. Now, a lot of people incorrectly call it nitrous oxide. And I've argued with some people in the chemistry profession, I am not a chemist, all right, that they were giving me a reason why you could call it that, but it's really oxides of nitrogen. And even though, as I said, I am not a chemist, but I was, if you look back at the old SAE and all the engineering and science papers from the late 60s and early 70s, Society of Automotive Engineers has papers that they call white papers, and they all refer to it as oxides of nitrogen. Only recently, with the advent of the Tier 4 emissions on diesels, that people start to call it nitrous oxide. It's not. It's oxides of nitrogen. Nitrous oxide is what the dentist gives you, and also what you shoot into a motor to make more power. It's an oxygenate. It carries oxygen, but it's oxides of nitrogen, NOx. And what happens with NOx is that it actually mixes and works with the ozone layer, and I shouldn't say the ozone, the ultraviolet lights of the sun, and ends up creating photochemical smog, which years ago Los Angeles was famous for. You go up on a mountain by where the Hollywood sign is and look down into LA, and it was all smog. It looked like it was always in the fog. And it mixes with that and makes photochemical smog, and also attacks the ozone layer of the earth, which is a protective layer of gases that God put around the earth to protect us from too much of the ultraviolet sun, and also has another effect on birds' shells. It weakens their shells, or so I was told. So it was recognized that the industry needs to start to clean up oxides of nitrogen, and we need to reduce oxides of nitrogen emissions. Now, the interesting thing about oxides of nitrogen, and anything time you have combustion, you are going to have oxides of nitrogen. You could have a barbecue grill going, and you're going to have oxides of nitrogen emissions coming from it. But inside an engine, the amount of oxides of nitrogen were increased exponentially than in an open flame like a barbecue grill. So there are three components that create oxides of nitrogen in the exhaust. And the person who actually figured this out and made an equation for it, or mathematical calculation to determine how it comes to be formed, was a Mr. Zeldovich. So it's actually called the Zeldovich equation. and that's probably more information you care to have. But in case you ever go on Jeopardy and they ask you what it is, you'll know that you'll say, what is the formula for oxides of nitrogen production, the Zeldovich equation. And in layperson's terms, and it doesn't need to get more complicated than that for this show today, or for you as a farmer, or even me as a guy with an engine guy, all right, is it takes three things to create oxides of nitrogen. It's pressure, heat, and exposure time, which is sometimes considered residence time. So you need pressure in the cylinder, you need heat, and you need to keep that pressure and heat together for a certain amount of time. So it's basically almost like a germination time, like a seed in the ground, or time to emerge. So in farming, we look at what GDU, growing degree units, heat units, to determine when we should have emergence. So the Zeldovich equation for oxides of nitrogen production looks at pressure in the cylinder, heat in the cylinder, and exposure time. And what exposure time means is that the flame speed across the bore in that engine. And we'll stop here for a second, and I'll just explain to you that the flame propagates across the bore in an engine, and though you may think it happens instantaneously, it really doesn't. It has to travel that bore, but the metric, the scale that it's used in, is milliseconds, which is thousandths of a second. So to our naked eye, if you were to see a film, there's optical engines that the industry have built that have clear cylinder head combustion chambers and a clear window in the cylinder. They can actually film the flame expanding across the bore. And that flame expanding across the bore, this is for gasoline or diesel, expanding across the bore is what actually, when it's expansion, it pushes against the piston as it's expanding and drives the piston down. And that's what imparts the chemical to mechanical energy from burning a fuel. You're taking chemical energy, which is creating a flame. The flame is expanding. It's working against the piston that is connected to that has a connecting rod that links it to the crankshaft. So the speed that flame travels can be measured, and it's measured in milliseconds. So if you have a very fast burn in the cylinder, then you would have less exposure time. If you would have a slow burn in the cylinder, you'd have more exposure time, because you're going to have the pressure and the cylinder pressure is not to be confused with compression ratio or cranking compression pressure. All right, that has an effect on cylinder pressure, but cylinder pressure is the amount of pressure that is created as the flame expands in the bore. So you'll have cylinder pressure, and then you'll have heat, the temperature of that flame, and then you'll have how quickly that flame burns. And if you take those three things together, that will create oxides of nitrogen, as far as an emission is concerned. Now, the key that we need to understand about this when it comes to EGR is that whenever you have the leading edge flame temperature, so that's the edge of the flame, so as it's going across the board, the hottest part, the leading edge of the flame, all right, once that gets above 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit F, the amount of oxides of nitrogen production goes up exponentially. If you're below 2,500 degrees, the amount of oxides of nitrogen is less. So 2,500 degrees is the inflection point where we go either ramp down dramatically or ramp up dramatically for our conversation. So the whole goal is to keep that flame temperature, that leading edge flame temperature, below 2,500 degrees. So you have two ways to control oxides of nitrogen production in an engine, in a cylinder. And you could either keep the temperature cool below 2,500 degrees, or you could increase the flame speed so that there is less exposure time. So it's a combination of exposure time, flame speed, and cylinder pressure. The thing that comes into play is that you need to have the cylinder pressure for the engine to make power. Cylinder pressure, which is, like, then again, repeating the expansion of the flame in the bore, and you need to have enough fuel to create enough heat for that, because an engine is a heat engine. It actually works on the caloric value of the fuel. We don't think of it that way. As we're going down the field and putting seed in the ground, that is the caloric value of diesel fuel that's actually running that tractor or any engine. And then you have the flame speed. So if we could modify the flame speed, or we could get the temperature cooler, then we could reduce oxides of nitrogen. But the balancing act is we still need this engine to be powerful, and we still need this engine to be fuel efficient. Its conversion from chemical to mechanical energy needs to be efficient, so otherwise it's basically a waste of time. So now what happened is that because Zeldovich discovered this, what is producing NOx, is that it was realized, and I don't know who it was realized by, but I guess, you know, a lot of these developments, like with agriculture, with no-till planting, vertical tillage, it's very hard. A couple of other things that can't come to mind right now. It's very hard to truly identify the father of any type of invention or any type of theory, because usually it's a culmination of many different thoughts, and one person or one company takes it to this level, and another company takes it to the next level, and then they realize that instead of going up, they need to go horizontal, and a third company takes it to this level, or a third designer or farmer. And you know, a lot of your farmer invented stuff, right? The cycloplanter, the precision planting meters or whatever. So it usually doesn't have one birth father. It's usually a culmination of American ingenuity that you're going to go and you're going to see a need, and you're going to recognize what we're doing, what the industry is doing is not the best way to do it, and then you're going to try to do something else. So I don't honestly know who discovered this or came up with this idea, but it was embraced by the entire industry. And what was recognized is that if you could put exhaust gas, which is already spent, right, exhaust gas is already burned, back into the cylinder, you can cool the flame, cool, C-O-O-L, cool the leading edge flame front temperature and get it below 2500 degrees so that you could be below that sweet spot to create oxides of nitrogen emissions. Now, this flies in exact contrast to what you would think. You say, how can you take something that's heated, hot exhaust, 600, 700, 800 degrees, 1,000 degrees, whatever it may be, all right, and put it back into the cylinder and lower the temperature? Conventional wisdom, that makes no sense, right? But conventional wisdom, if we apply it to the next level, all right, and use some critical thinking, is that in essence what EGR is, exhaust gas recirculation, is it's a filler. It's a filler. It's like a carrier. So you're going into your sprayer tanks. Let's say you're putting 2 quarts per acre of Roundup in 20 gallons of water. All right, so the water is the carrier for the Roundup, or the water is the carrier for whatever you're putting in there. So we have a chemical amount of chemical we put in, and then we have a water as a carrier. So what's happening is that with EGR, what was discovered was that even though the exhaust gas is hot, it's taking the place of a combustible mixture. And by taking the place of a combustible mixture, it is not allowing the flame to reach that 2500 degree critical temperature to create oxides of nitrogen. So in essence, it's quenching the flame, but it's quenching it by having less combustible mixture in there. And what's happening is that we have to say combustible mixture because by the time it gets to the cylinder, it is a combination of fuel and air homogenized together. So the EGR is taking place at the combustible mixture, and that in turn is allowing you to have a cooler flame temperature, which is less fuel to burn, and then reduce oxides of nitrogen emissions. And then to add to that, the combustion chamber design, be it a gasoline or a diesel engine, diesel engine, more of the combustion chamber is actually in the top of the piston, the crown of the piston, than it is in the cylinder head. But a gasoline engine, it's the exact opposite. But by the combustion chamber design, a proper combustion chamber is allowed, or not allowed, will create, will induce, is probably a better word, will induce a faster burn time, a faster flame speed. So instead of, let's say, that we're 10 milliseconds, all right, to go across the bore, we may have a different combustion chamber design, and now it only takes, it's meters per second, so 10 milliseconds would be slower than 25 milliseconds, like 10 miles per hour slower than 25 miles per hour. So the thing is that if we have 25 millisecond burn rate and we introduce some EGR, we're able to control oxides of nitrogen emissions dramatically. And that was one of the key elements of the Tier 3 into Tier 4 and then Tier 4B, some people call it, or Tier 4 final, and us going eventually into Tier 5. So let's recap here so that you understand. Oxides of nitrogen emissions creates, well, simplistic terms, create smog, attack the ozone layer. They are produced through pressure, heat, and exposure time. If you look at some, the Zeldovich equation calls it residence time, meaning how long that pressure and heat is staying in the cylinder, which is determined by the burn rate of the flame. And so I like to say exposure time, because it's how long is it exposed to it, right? Because we'll have like a we spray a field, we will have a re-entry interval, right? You have to put up the flag or whatever, red flag, whatever color it is. We don't do anything that has REI, so I'm not concerned with it, but I'm cognizant of it. And then that's your re-entry. When can you go back into that field so that you could be exposed? So it's your exposure time. If you're going out in the sun, right? If you're going out in the sun, you say the length of time that you're out in the sun is your exposure time. So we're talking about exposure time here. But the actual equation, if you look up the Zeldovich equation, will say residence time. Ready? And that will produce, so if we could control the flame speed or control the temperature, we will reduce the oxides of nitrogen emission. And now, the easiest way to do this is through exhaust gas recirculation. And by putting in the exhaust gas, which is inert, cannot burn, it's acting like a carrier, it's acting like a filler coming into the cylinder, all right, it doesn't allow as much combustible mixture to come and lowers the temperature. Now, on the early gasoline engines, all right, and the reason why I want to show you this timeline of how this evolved, on the early gasoline engines back in the 70s into the 80s and probably into the early 90s, I mean, this would be an EGR valve on an engine on your pickup truck, your family car, what have you. The thing is that lots of times they did not put EGR, if it was an 8-cylinder motor, into all 8 cylinders. Usually the EGR was introduced through the intake manifold through a passage that was into just enough cylinders to get the vehicle to be legal and pass the emission test. As time went on and things became more stringent, they would introduce EGR, which is the inert gas, the inert exhaust gas, into all of the cylinders, all 8 cylinders or 6 cylinders, what have you. Right, and then so in the beginning they were just looking to pass the test, right? Like a kid studying. Hey, as long as I get this, I got a passing grade, I'm out of here, I don't care. They weren't looking to ace the test, they were looking to pass. So what they were looking to do was just pass the EPA test. And the reason why they did that was not because they didn't want to make an extra passage in the intake manifold, is that EGR, when introduced, it introduced skews, messes up, you know, screws up the burn cycle in that cylinder. So it was determined that if we cooled down these cylinders, all right, we'd get enough reduction in oxides of nitrogen that we could let the other cylinders burn, have a better burn rate, and then it would be of less of a power drop off and a drivability concern for the owner of the vehicle. Because you have to remember, when you're introducing EGR, you are having less heat in that cylinder, less oxides of nitrogen, right, of it being produced, but also that particular bore at that given point is producing less power. So that is a problem. So they felt that if they just introduce EGR to the cylinders that are necessary, just enough to get it to pass the tailpipe test, that they would be happy. Then now, as time went on, we got EGR introduced to all cylinders. Now, to talk about a diesel engine, whether this is light duty or heavy duty in a piece of farm equipment, is that the diesel engine, by nature of its combustion event, is very high cylinder pressure, or very high cylinder pressure, and very slow burn time. So it's pressure, heat, and exposure time, right? So very slow burn time, because diesel fuel on its own burns very slowly. It doesn't have the flame speed of gasoline. So you have the high cylinder pressure, you have temperature from combustion, and then you have this very, very, very slow burn rate. So that's why diesel engines are being attacked by so many people. And then even in Europe, they're talking about getting rid of diesels whatsoever. Right, maybe not so much for ag equipment, but for trucks and anything that's going on the road. And hopefully that does not happen here. But that slow burn speed and that high cylinder pressure is just like, you know, you get a crop that's got hail damage or injury on it, it's more susceptible to some sort of disease because of the open, I'm going to use the word pores, P-O-R-E-S, but it's not really a pore, that the leaves and the stalk are all damaged and have open areas, like a cut on your finger where you could get infection in. So the diesel is very, very ripe to make oxides of nitrogen, and that's why it's had a target on its back for so many years, and now that's starting to happen here in the United States. And so it had two main components that they were gunning for, because it has a huge propensity to create oxides of nitrogen, and it has a huge propensity to create particulate matter in the exhaust, which is soot. All right, and then this actually the TF4 emissions program is addressing the oxides of nitrogen, but also the amount of soot and the size of the soot particles. So years ago, you'd see some black smoke, all right, and that soot, even though you could have a TF4 engine run beautifully clean, you see nothing but heat coming out of the exhaust, the soot particles are still there, albeit not as many as it was when it was blowing black smoke 20 years ago or 30 years ago. Right, but those are the two targets as far as carbon monoxide and hydrocarbons. Diesels are excellent as far as that's concerned, and the gasoline engine is the offender. The gasoline engine has very little particulate matter in its exhaust, and they were able to easily control the oxides of nitrogen through EGR, but the diesel's real burden that it's carrying is its particulate matter and its oxides of nitrogen. So now, what basically happened is that it was recognized that the same theory of introducing an inert exhaust gas as a filler into the cylinder of a diesel engine will lower the temperature of the leading edge flame, and that will reduce the oxides of nitrogen production. Now, there's also been some work on with combustion chamber designs and to highly manage the combustion event to increase the flame speed, the burn speed. So that will produce the oxides of nitrogen also, but the majority of the work is being done with trying to get that temperature down, and then the second aspect, part B of that task, is to try to increase the flame speed. And one of the reasons why, if you look back in the history of diesel engines, and I mean, they were in the beginning, they were normally aspirated, and then what basically happened is that the industry started to add turbochargers for forced induction, and years ago it was done for power. But now it has been recognized that by turbocharging a diesel engine is that you are increasing the flame speed, because the turbocharger basically is a fan, and what it's doing is it's forcing more air into the cylinder, but that air that's coming into the cylinder is creating a lot of turbulence, and that turbulence around the cylinder, because it's blowing it in like you blowing turning up the wind on a combine, right? To blow all the Don kernels out of the back. So the thing is that, so this wind coming from the turbocharger, the speed of the velocity of the air coming to the engine makes it go faster, all right? And the faster the burn speed, right, you will have lower oxides of nitrogen production, plus you will have a quicker pressure rise in the cylinder to make more power from that gallon of fuel or liter of fuel, whatever standard you're measuring it by. So, contrary to the turbocharger's first existence on a diesel engine, where its sole purpose was to increase the power, it's still used to increase the power, but it's also used as an emission control device or theory, because it increases the burn speed. And if you increase the burn speed, you are going to have lower oxides of nitrogen emission. And as an aside to that, if you could get a quicker burn speed, you will have lower particulate matter, right? But its main thing is the increased burn speed will allow it to have a lower oxides of nitrogen. So now, you put this together, and most modern diesel engines will have an EGR system on it. And they were quite elaborate today, and they're quite elaborate. All right, they have the first EGR valves on the gas motor was simply lifted with a vacuum signal from the carburetor, and then it went to electronic controls, and now they're basically electronically controlled. The thing that you need to understand, and this is where the meat and potatoes of this show is going to come today, as I start to wrap up for the close here, is that what you need to understand is that EGR is not administered to all engine operating states. So at idle, years ago, the old 5.7 Oldsmobile GM diesels and the 6.2 liters, they actually introduced EGR at idle, which was the totally opposite concept of a gasoline engine. A gasoline engine only saw EGR at part throttle light load. At idle, there was no EGR. And at high load, there was no EGR, because what happened is that at part throttle light load, you had the leanest mixture, which was creating the highest cylinder temperatures. So with the highest cylinder temperatures, they wanted to cool it down. And then those older mechanical diesels that were found in those light-duty pickup trucks and those like Oldsmobile of diesel engines and what have you, and probably other applications, Volkswagen and what have you, but I wasn't that familiar with those as I was the GM stuff, was that that they would introduce EGR at idle because that's when they were producing a high level of oxides of nitrogen emission, and then as you started to get into the throttle and drive the vehicle, the mixture was richer, and the richer mixture not only allows it to make more power, but act as a coolant, as a quench. Because you'd say to me, if you were paying attention, say, Ray, that we're worried about cylinder pressure, you said, and then if I have a richer mixture, I'm going to make more cylinder pressure. Yes, but also that richer mixture, though it fueled the engine, was slightly overfueled, and it actually worked as a quench, as a coolant, than the leaner mixture. So there was more fuel, so it was kind of wetting it down for layperson's terms. It's not quite as simplistic as that, but for us in agriculture, that's all we need to understand, that they were using the fuel as a coolant. And the same thing happened in the gasoline engine, but in the exact opposite sense, whereas one of the richest times in the gasoline engine is at idle, because the throttle plates are closed, so the amount of air being pumped through the engine is minimal. But so then they started to, then the tier 3 and tier 4 came out, is that the manufacturers became very, very dependent on exhaust gas recirculation to help meet the oxides of nitrogen emission standards. And as an aside to that, if you have any engine that uses diesel exhaust fluid, which is deionized water and urea mixed together, it's not cow urine like some people think it is. It's basically automotive grade urea, which is a different grade but the same chemical. It's supposed to be cleaner than what we would spin on to a cornfield, that type of urea pellets. And so that's mixed together. So if you have an engine, a diesel engine that employs diesel exhaust fluid, DEF, then that is to reduce oxides of nitrogen production, and that happens in this, what is called an SCR system, supplemental catalytic reduction, which what it was called in the beginning, but now the official name is selective, not supplemental, selective catalytic reduction, which is the official SAE, Society of Automotive Engineers, name for that. So what that diesel exhaust fluid works in conjunction with these precious metals inside this SCR system, SCR catalyst, and the word catalyst means it speeds up a chemical reaction without itself becoming consumed, and then it works also in tandem with the EGR. The EGR happens inside the engine because the exhaust gas is being reintroduced to the cylinder, right? So anything else like the SCR system is downstream of the engine, and that is in the exhaust stream, but EGR happens inside the engine. So what they do is that as the standards got to be stricter, then they will put EGR in and they'll clean up as much as they can, and then the DEF and the SCR, the DEF slash SCR working together, the SCR does nothing without the DEF, is that it's going to clean up the rest of the oxides of nitrogen to make it legal. All right, so that is what that's all about in a nutshell. All right, they even say, that's fine, hot rod farmer, but I don't feel like listening to somebody sitting in my combine harvesting wheat listening to a chemistry lesson. Well, I agree with you. You may not want to, but I need to give you that to understand what's happening so we could identify the pitfalls of this system that will be on your equipment. And we're going to focus the next few minutes of the show on the diesel engine because that has the most complex EGR system because of its combustion pressure and its slow burn speed, whereas a gasoline engine, even a 2020 gasoline engine, has a very, very simplistic EGR system, unlike a diesel has. Now, most diesel applications today incorporate a cooler that runs engine coolant through it. And the cooler is there to help further lower the temperature of the inert exhaust gas. So when it enters the cylinders, it quenches that leading edge flame front temperature way below 2,500 degrees. So if we could cool it down more, it's going to be more effective as far as cooling down that charge temperature in the cylinder. All right. So that means you're running an EGR cooler, and this EGR cooler is taking the engine coolant, and it is putting it through, or let me put it this way, it's taking coolant. That's a misnomer, what I said, and putting it through this heat exchanger, which looks like a radiator, and it's cooling the exhaust gas before it enters into the cylinder. Now, this is what, in the agricultural chemical industry, right, you talk to an agronomist, you ask about how we're using this on this product, or using how many quarts per acre, or what have you, and he'll say, follow label instructions, follow label recommendations. So you always follow the label, right? Well, in the engineering community, our get-out-of-jail-card is application-specific. So instead of following label, we say application-specific. And the reason why I'm saying that to you now is that, for the most part, most engines that have an EGR cooler, depending upon the design of the engine, may use the engine coolant, or it may have its own coolant supply, which is usually engine coolant also. So there would be engine coolant that goes through the engine to remove the heat from the engine, and then there is a subsystem which removes the heat from the EGR to cool that air, that filler that's going into the cylinder to lower the temperature below 2,500 degrees. Now, and so it all depends on what you need to basically identify on all of your diesels that have an EGR system. Well, if you have to first identify where the valve is, it's piping to the valve, if it's cooled, and how it's cooled. Is it cooled by a dedicated heat exchanger and coolant for and coolant supply for that, or is it using the engine coolant? And due to the high temperature of the exhaust gas in relationship to what the coolant is going to see inside the engine, is that most times an engine will have a dedicated EGR coolant supply that does not commingle with the engine coolant, because those thermal cycles will actually degrade that coolant at a faster rate than it would inside the engine. But like I say, you could find some that are and some that are. So the first step, number one, is to identify the EGR valve on your engine and to identify whether it is cooled, and if it's cooled, where its coolant path is. Now, what happens is that a lot of people don't realize, especially today, and these engines are so complicated, have so much junk under the hood, whether it's a truck or if it's a combine, that you can't, you really need to search to find things. So one of the problems that people have, what the industry has seen, is that you'll have an engine that has a dedicated coolant supply for the EGR valve. The person is good about changing the coolant in the engine, but neglects changing the coolant in the EGR system, all right? And if that is the case, or if it's using coolant from the engine feeding the EGR, then that is good as far as changing the coolant and renewing the coolant, and it's using up all the additives, and then now this coolant is attacking both the liners in the diesel engine and the EGR system. If it's a dedicated EGR system, it's only going to attack the cooler and its lines, all right? And then what happens is that you have a coolant failure, and depending upon the system, again, application specific, is that you could end up putting coolant into the engine, and first you're going to get white steam, white smoke, all right, specifically like on startup, and getting coolant into the engine, and or if it leaks badly enough, and depending upon where it's leaking, you could actually hydro-lock the engine, hydrostatically lock up the engine by filling it up with coolant and trying to compress the charge with coolant in it. And we all know that when we hydro-lock an engine, usually the connecting rod kicks through the block, and that engine is junk, or at least breaks the piston. So the first step as a farmer, because we don't want this equipment to break, so the first step on a farmer is to identify that EGR system and how it's cooled and if it's cooled. And if it is cooled independently, we need to be able to be mindful that we have to change that coolant and maintain that coolant with just as much vigor as we do the engine coolant. The next thing that we have to understand is that there's a flip side of cooling the charge. The flip side of cooling the charge is that when it's cooler, it has a propensity to build more carbon in the EGR passages. And if you have a diesel engine that does a lot of idling or a lot of short town trips, is that you're going to build a lot of carbon in that exhaust. Now you're building a lot of carbon in the exhaust, and then you're cooling that charge, which has the effect of building more carbon. So what's happening is that the EGR system is very prone to plugging, exhaust gas plugging from carbon. And it's coming from two different things, is that if the engine is running properly and used in the duty cycle that it was intended to, not sitting there and idling like a power company truck, all right, it's going to build less carbon in the exhaust. All right, and then the way it's designed, the cooling effect of the cool EGR with the cooler is not really going to add much carbon content in that valve and those passageways and plug it. So that is fine. But if you have an engine that is either used for a lot of short duty cycles and or does not have an efficient combustion event, and or the owner is not good with changing the oil or using the wrong type of oil, you're going to get a lot of blow-by, a lot of oil fumes coming into that combustion event. Or if you have dirty injectors or low cetane fuel or a poor burn rate in the fuel, that diesel engine is going to create a lot of carbon. You're going to go down the road, you're not going to know it, down the field, but you're not going to know it. But it's not going to run as well. But it's going to be a high carbon producer. Now, what will happen is that over time, you will actually plug those EGR passages in that EGR valve and its pipes and tubes that go to it. And if you have that type of use, and then you add a cooled EGR, you're putting salt on the wound. The cooled EGR, people think the cooled EGR is the problem. The cooled EGR is not the problem. The problem with the cooled EGR is that you're degrading the coolant and the cooler is falling apart, the actual heat exchanger, but it's not building the carbon. The poor running engine, and when I say poor, it doesn't mean that you may think it's running fine, but a combustion event that has dirty injectors, low cetane fuel, all right, does a lot of idling. You have best fuel in the world, you do everything in the world, and you're not good with changing the oil, or you use an oil that does not meet the specification for that manufacturer, that diesel engine, you're going to build a lot of carbon, and you're going to end up plugging that EGR system. And when you plug that EGR system, you know, when all us guys got engaged, what do? We bought as soon as they accepted the ring, they transferred from our girlfriend to our fiance that diamond ring, right? And what's that diamond? The diamond is a piece of carbon, right? Zeldovich equation. It's carbon through heat, pressure, and time that diamond was created. And you will actually build rock hard carbon. I'm sorry, hit the microphone. Rock hard carbon in the passages, which will block the EGR system from working, all right? The EGR system has, most of them have temperature probes on them or some way to determine the flow rate, and this is part of the Tier 4 emissions so that it could determine what's going on. So if you block that EGR, two things are going to happen. You're going to have less reduction of the oxides of nitrogen in the cylinder bore, and then your SCR system is going to have to introduce more DEF to try to clean it up, all right? And then if you have building a lot of carbon, there's nothing to do with EGR, you're going to have more particulate matter. So that you're going to end up plugging that diesel particulate filter more, and you're going to go through more regen cycles. So the whole idea is that it's like weeds in the field, right? You don't want to worry about getting rid of the weeds. You don't want them to grow. So you want no weeds, not trying to eradicate them and burn them down. So the thing is that you need to have a good combustion event, and that basically is fuel and oil and the type of driving cycles or use cycles, what we call duty cycle. So now what will happen is that the government has mandated that when you plug that EGR system or at a certain point that the oxides of nitrogen can no longer be controlled through the SCR system, and which is SCR/DEF, is that it will set a code. Now, a lot of people don't know this, and this is for gasoline and for diesel engines also, is that in some applications, in some instances, some trouble codes, when they're set in the memory, are intentionally designed to make the engine run poorly. So you could have, for instance, an EGR code, and the thing starts to run like a bag of bolts. And that's actually programmed for that to happen, because they knew that the consumer, if it didn't run poorly, the consumer is not getting it fixed. And that's the same thing that happens on gasoline engines, right? You have certain codes that are set, and the car runs, idles, poorly, bucks, lacks powers, maybe possibly stalling. They usually refrain from stalling because they don't want to have a legal thing where the car guy's trying to take somebody to the hospital and the car stalls on them. But they usually have an algorithm in there that makes it run very poorly. So you could be having a coffee shop and say, man, I got an EGR code in my combine. The thing is running like a bag of bolts. And the reason why it's running like a bag of bolts has nothing to do with the EGR. It's an algorithm that's instituted to make it run poorly, so you fix it. So as the hot rod farmer, not only am I concerned about the air quality and the inside of your engine, I want you to be profitable. I want you to be profitable and not have to fix and take apart a whole EGR system. And if you can't get that carbon out with different chemicals, soaking, you're buying all those components, and they're not cheap. And it will put the engine into a limpo mode, and you cannot use that piece of equipment. So that's something that we need to understand. So to recap here, How do we control EGR? How do we maintain EGR? Very simple. We identify if it's a liquid-cooled system, where the liquid is coming from that cools it, and maintain that so it can not have a deterioration of the heat exchanger. We need to have an efficient combustion event, and we need to have an efficient combustion event and limit the amount of idling of the engine. And I'm probably sitting, somebody's listening to this right now, idling a combine with the AC on, right, waiting for the grain cart to come. But we need to limit the idling, and specifically the short trip cycles. The short trip cycles are of more detriment than the idle. If you're cutting wheat, and then you come and you're waiting for the grain cart to come back from being dumped, and it's sitting in idling for 10 or 15 minutes, that engine is hot. That's not a problem. It's the short cycles, the short starts and stops that build a lot of carbon. And we need to make sure that the crankcase ventilation system is working properly, but more importantly, we use an oil, an engine oil, with the proper specifications for that engine. Now, keep in mind that the industry, so Case IH, John Deere, Cummins, what have you, they don't publish all their specifications. So if you buy an oil and it says meets this specification or can be used in Cummins, it all depends. You have to do some research, and I'm just throwing names around to see if it truly meets that specification. And because sometimes they don't publish all specifications. So that's why we say with today's modern engines, use the OE oil. Use, if you get Case, use the Case, whatever, the Amber oil, John Deere, use their oil, what have you. You know you're getting the additive package. It's like knowing that you're getting the fertility package that you want, or you're getting, you know, the package, the genetics package in your seed. So you don't just say, well, seed to hell with it, I'm throwing anything in the ground. Right? The thing is that, so you need to do that. And if you do those three things, that the EGR system will not be problematic. You're not going to load it with carbon. You're not going to go into a limp home mode where you need to go and put seed in the ground, and you're trying to get that tractor going, and all of a sudden has lost EGR flow, and it sets a code, and the thing is hardly getting back to the barn. All right? So we don't need to do it. Very simple to maintain that system. And if you maintain it, it is not problematic. It's just like if you brush your teeth, you're not getting cavities and going for dentures. So the thing basically is, people who have told you that they're problematic is because they never really maintained it. And at that particular point, they're getting their teeth all pulled, metaphorically. So now, if you have any questions on that, please feel free to contact me at hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com. And now we're gonna close with our special delivery. And special delivery is brought to you by Firestone Ag, a company founded by Harvey Firestone, a fourth-generation farmer from Columbiana, Ohio. Harvey dreamed of putting rubber tires on farm tractors, and his innovative mindset is the core of Firestone Ag today and lives on with a 23-degree tread bar, AD2 technology, and the Firestone of replacement tracks. The soil is the lifeblood of your farm. Trust it only to Firestone. All right, we have our letter, and it is from Gene Wurst in Nevada. And it says, hello, Ray. I want to let you know how much I enjoy listening to your show. Well, thank you, Gene. As I said in the beginning, he's been a faithful person that jumped onto this podcast in the early days. I agree with you 100% concerning your show about being just operators. I had a show a week or two ago about don't be an occupant, an operator, be a driver and be a mechanic. We are a much disconnected society today. I own 3 cars, all manual transmissions. I like to say I drive my cars as opposed to operate an automobile. My question today, excuse me, I had to hit the cough button. My question today is concerning turbochargers. I own a Ford Focus with a gasoline turbo direct GT TDI engine. In a 6-speed manual transmission. When I arrive at where I'm going, should I let the engine idle for a minute or so before shutting it off to allow the impeller in the turbo to slow down or stop turning? Years ago, I had a 20th anniversary Trans Am with a 3.8 turbocharged engine. In those years, we had to have the engine idle down. It's the same hold true today. Should I do it as a best practice? Thank you for all you do, and please keep your shows and commentary coming. Gene Wurst, Nevada. Thank you so much, Gene, for the kind words. The answer basically is, with any engine, turbocharged or not, I like to let it idle for at least 30 seconds before I shut it off. And if you come to where you're going, if you let the car idle, if you have the air conditioner on, you shut the air conditioner off while it's idling, you disconnect your seatbelt, put your glasses away, and then shut the car off. The reason why I like to do that, which is independent of a turbocharger even, is that you want to let the coolant run through the engine, and you want to limit the amount of heat soak. And if you let the engine idle, you're going to be putting coolant through the engine, and you're going to have a diminished temperature, thermal, what we call thermal excursion, in the cylinder head. And most engines, they have aluminum cylinder heads, so you want to try to get that heat from combustion out of there, because at idle, the engine is producing very little heat because there's not much fuel being burned because there's no load on it. So you want to let that coolant circulate and pull that heat down. And the same thing happens with the turbocharger. Years ago, they would tell you to idle it down, as you said, and it was, one was not so much for heat, but to keep oil to the bearing, so it wasn't really spinning too fast before it, as it shut off, and then the bearing would have no oil on it. The truth be known today, the oils are so much better, and the oiling path that goes to the turbocharger is so much more efficient. Years ago, a turbocharger, specifically on a gasoline engine, was an afterthought, and it's usually its oiling passageway, its oil feed, not its return, was compromised as a retrofit. Today's engines, if you are basically designed with the turbocharger on it, and the turbocharger is meant to be a core part of the engine. So look, if you look at the Ford EcoBoost engines, which you happen to have in that Focus, because I know the type of car, is that if you look at anybody's turbocharged engine today, the turbocharger is designed to be like a crankshaft to last the life of the vehicle. It's not a consumable bolt-on as it was before. So to answer your question, using your own very, very good words, what is the best practice? The best practice with any engine, turbocharged or not, is let it idle for 30 seconds, 25 seconds, 45 seconds. You don't have to look at your watch. You don't have to be there a minute. You come and, take your glasses off, shut the air conditioner off, shut the heater, close the window, whatever you're doing, turn the radio down, unplug your seatbelt, and then when you're ready to exit the car or the farm machine, shut it off then, and then you will be fine, and everything will be happy. Not only will your turbocharger have some heat pulled out of it, but your, more importantly, the cylinder head will. So listen, thank you so much for allowing this to be, as I said, my 53rd show. I greatly appreciate and find all of you. I'm honored that you listen to me and take an hour of your life to listen to this dry land farmer from New Jersey. And please know that the Hot Rod Farmer is pulling for you, the American farmer and rancher, and my beloved, beloved America. You have a blessed week, and I went long, and I'm sorry, so hopefully you enjoyed it. And stop by next week and give me a click. Take care. Bye-bye.